You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been well over 70 years since Allied troops liberated Nazi concentration camps, revealing to a horrified world the astounding scope and cruelty of Hitler's so-called final solution. Some 11 million people were killed during the Holocaust. Those who survived have lived so long they're now watching the world forget. A recent poll found the Holocaust fading from public memory, particularly for younger Americans. 66% of American millennials don't know what Auschwitz is. 22% had never heard of the Holocaust or weren't sure if they had. So there is fresh urgency in recording and remembering the stories of survivors like Irene Hassenberg Butter. In the spring of 1943, Irene and her family were ordered out of their Amsterdam apartment, loaded into a cattle car, sent to a holding camp, and then eventually transported to the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. Irene Butter tells her story of survival and forgiveness in her memoir, Shores Beyond Shores, From Holocaust to Hope, My True Story, which came out earlier this year. When I talked to her in April, I asked her to start by telling me about her family, the Hassenbergs.
My father came from a large family. He had five brothers and three sisters. And strangely enough, he is the only one who perished in the Holocaust. Several of them were in camps. Several of them emigrated from Germany to South America, some to the United States. Some stayed in Germany, hidden. So I really don't understand why he was the one that didn't make it.
And there was yourself, your brother, and mom and dad.
My grandparents.
And your grandparents, that's right, who helped you plant things. We learn about this little girl's life, and you were just five when you asked your mother, what is the black zigzag on all of those flags? The first time you noticed the swastika on the Nazi flag?
Right, yes.
And how did she respond to...
She didn't want me to see them. She said, look away, it's not important.
And I know that your family wound up fleeing Berlin for Amsterdam, hoping that that would be a safe enough distance. But very quickly, as we see in your memoir, it was not a safe distance, and the Nazi noose steadily tightened around your family. How many changes did you have to go through as a little girl going to school? What did those restrictions feel like?
They were oppressive. Actually, we didn't experience, well, my grandfather owned a bank and that was taken away from him in Berlin. So that's why we went to Holland. My father was looking for a job because he was unemployed and jobs were very difficult to find for Jews at that point. Then we came to Amsterdam and we had two really wonderful years, except there was a lot of tension, because Jews were being persecuted already, and some who managed to leave Germany stopped in Amsterdam on their way to other places. But still, it was a time of uncertainty. Then in 1940, the Germans invaded, and then Holland became an occupied country, and the Nazi regime took over all the rules and all the regulations.
And as a little girl, how did that change your life? What were some of the rules and regulations that have affected you?
Well, it was very difficult. We had a curfew. We were barred from all public places, theaters, movies, parks, libraries, swimming pools. That was the first restriction. Then we couldn't be in the homes of non-Jewish people, and they couldn't visit us. My best friend was not Jewish, so we could only play together out on the street. Then we couldn't buy food. We were not allowed to enter the food stores till after three, and it was war, so there wasn't much left at that time. We had to wear the Star of David, the Jewish star, at all times, so there was no question about who was Jewish and who was not. We were evicted from the public schools, had to go to Jewish schools. And then the deportation started. So that, of course, was the worst.
And we see this through your eyes as a very small child, that people just started going away and it was like waiting for the shoe to drop. I should note you actually knew Anne Frank because she lived near you in Amsterdam?
Well, I knew who she was. I didn't actually know her. Well, I knew her through mutual friends. She was 2 years older and went to a different school.
That's stunning. And I know, as we learn in your book, you actually met up with her again briefly while you were both in Bergen-Belsen. The deportation order finally comes for your family in June 1943. And there you were, all loaded onto a cattle car for transport to Camp Westerbork. What do you most remember about that train trip and that car?
Well, that was pretty horrible. It was a very hot day to begin with. Everything we took with us, we had to carry. And we were stuffed into these wagons, these cattle car wagons, 60, 70, 80 people. No air, no water, no toilets.
One bucket, right?
One bucket, right, yes. So it was pretty gruesome. I learned only later that many people who were deported to the east, to the death camps, were in those cars for 5-6 days. And that just seems unimaginable to me, how one could survive.
We have a sense in reading and learning about the Holocaust of families being split up and sundered in the process. But the four of you managed to stay together in that first transit camp and also at Bergen-Belsen. Looking back, does that fact surprise you, that you were able to stay together as a family of four?
Well, I don't think... I didn't expect anything else, you know, because I didn't know what was going on. We had very little information about anything. But I think one reason was that my father had managed to get these South American passports, Ecuadorian passports, and that changed our status. We were not just Jews. We were exchange Jews. And we were in a separate camp in Bergen-Belsen. Bergen-Belsen had 8 camps. And we were in the camp where most of the inhabitants had some sort of passport, citizenship, or visa to another country. And the Germans wanted to capitalize on that because they could get their German citizens back, they thought. So that, I think, was one reason. And when we left Westerbork, we were told, you're going to Bergen-Belsen, it's a better camp, and you won't be there long because you're going to be exchanged. None of that was true.
No, because in February 1944, you went to Bergen-Belsen, so there you were in Germany, and they told you it was going to be a better camp. What was it really as far as the change in your daily life?
It was very dismal, and we saw it as we entered the camp. It was terrible. It was grim. It had barbed wire fences. People were at the fences. They were emaciated. They wore rags. They looked angry, sick. So we could tell right away, this isn't going to be better.
I'm talking with Irene Butter, whose memoir is Shores Beyond Shores, From Holocaust to Hope, My True Story. If you were to think of your time at Bergen-Belsen, what sight, sound, smell, what best sums up that time to you?
Smell, for sure. Yeah, something I've taken with me for the rest of my life. The toilets were outhouses. They were never cleaned. There were just holes in a bench. People in the barracks, if they couldn't make it to the outhouse, you know what happened. I think we had 2 showers in 1 year. There were no showers in the barracks, only big public showers that they could take you to, but didn't. No soap, no hot water. Clothes were filthy and just illness.
And they kept piling in more people. I know at the end of July 1944, there were about 7,300 prisoners interned in Bergen-Belsen. By early 1945, it was 22,000. How did that overcrowding affect the way that people were towards each other?
Well, it affected us physically because we were being moved into different barracks all the time. And then the beds were bunk beds, narrow, steel-framed, three decks, and then 2 persons to each bed. So my brother and my father had 1 bed, my mother and I had 1, but it was just a narrow bed. And then people were all around you in the beds. And this kind of crowding, you know, with lice. Lice are the transmitters of disease. And everybody had lice. You couldn't get rid of them. They nested in our clothing, and there was no way.
And it's clear from the stories you tell in your memoir, Shores Beyond Shores, it was open game. Theft, if you had a piece of something and somebody else saw it, they thought nothing of taking it away from you. It makes me wonder, did you ever in your time at either camp, Irene Butter, did you ever witness any expression of humanity from the Nazis or from the Jewish prisoners who helped them run the camps?
Well, from the Nazis, I didn't, but my father said he once got a cigarette from a soldier, once. But I didn't see any humanity around me. If they were in an aggressive mood, they could do anything. They could beat you up. They could shoot you. You were scared all the time. Every moment was uncertain, and anxiety reigned.
And then from the Jewish prisoners who ran the camps, there's one in particular that really bedeviled you. And I have to note, there's a beautiful grace note at the end of your book where you tell us you did use a pseudonym for one of the people who made your life very, very hard in that first camp, saying this person was one of my first lessons in understanding and forgiveness. I honor that by giving her and her descendants anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
What was your key to reaching that level of forgiveness?
Well, I didn't know at first. She really had it out for me and my family. She was alone. She was her husband had died, I think. Her children weren't with her. And I imagined myself being alone.
The idea that you got out of the camp through an exchange, I think will be startling to a lot of people who kind of assumed that everybody was just kept and that will be surprised to realize that the Nazis released anyone for any reason. But you got out because of that Ecuadorian passport.
Right. It was a prisoner exchange. We got out because German citizens came in. Some prisoners, maybe, I don't know, but most of them were internees in Texas, in a camp in Texas. And so it was more important to the Nazis to get these people back to help fight the war than to kill a few more Jews.
So you did get out, and you need to read Irene's book to see the fascinating story of her trip through Algeria. No parents, no brother at that point. You were on your own. But you eventually get to the United States. You marry. You went on to have a distinguished career in academia, professor emerita now of public health at the University of Michigan. As you were building your new life in the United States, did you talk openly about surviving the Holocaust or stuff it away?
For four decades, I didn't talk. Many others didn't talk. My family and I didn't talk about it, hardly ever.
So what changed?
The change was a realization of the responsibility to be a witness, to provide testimony, to allow people to learn what really happened. And so that's how I began talking to schools, in schools, to many, many students over a long period of time. That actually was one of the motivations to write the book. Someday, if I can't go to schools anymore, then my story will be available.
When you look, Irene, at where we are in 2018, neo-fascists emerging in Europe, a white national subculture thriving on the internet that is actually now out in the open. You think of Charlottesville last August with neo-Nazis parading openly. When you saw those images from Charlottesville, people openly waving that swastika flag and shouting, "Jews will not replace us," in blood and soil. Did you expect to face those images again in your lifetime?
Never. Certainly not in this country. And that's why I am glad that my book is coming out now, because had I written it 20 years ago, it wouldn't be as relevant as it is today. And I think it's an illustration of how history repeats itself. And we've used the phrase "never again" for so long now, but never again doesn't happen unless we fight for it. And that's why I think it's so important that young people learn, become aware of the consequences of authoritarianism, white supremacy, ethnic cleansing, all these concepts. They should have been wiped out a long time ago, but here they are again.
And here we are with the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, telling us that in 2017, anti-Semitic incidents were up nearly 60% from the previous year. In fact, late last summer after Charlottesville, an ABC Washington Post poll found 9% of Americans believe it is acceptable to hold neo-Nazi views. What do you see at work here in our country to have this climate?
Well, it's a good question. I think it's fostered. You know, it was kind of underground for a long time. It wasn't acceptable.
Living on the internet.
Wasn't politically correct to have these views. And now it's allowed to express itself.
Why?
Why? Because I think one reason is racism. And there's also a great deal of dissatisfaction amongst people who see the country getting wealthier and wealthier, and their economic status is in decline, and it hasn't been addressed properly, as it should be.
So let's blame them, whatever, the air quotes around the them, for that inequality. Does that echo things that history tells us were spoken in the 1930s and the 1920s?
Definitely. We have to talk to them.
Is that how we keep the world from forgetting?
Well, at least it's an attempt. It's an effort. If we don't, I don't know what else would happen that would change it.
Irene Butter, author of Shores Beyond Shores, From Holocaust to Hope, My True Story. It is a powerful book and a powerful story, and it is wonderful to have you here as a living testimonial that forgiveness and survival can happen, and they are beautiful. Irene, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.